We had a successful work day yesterday. So if you were here and you were at work day yesterday, I assume that means you took your medicine and everything hurts. So thank you all for your help. We got a lot of stuff done. I mean, there's always more you could do, but we got some really big things done that are going to help us make some necessary changes around here to help all of us. So thank you very much for all of your hard work. I do notice that many of you who were at work day yesterday are not here this morning because you were at work day yesterday. Thank you for your extra hard work. For more on that, you should know that Lance, for example, spent most of his day underneath the elevator at the bottom of the shaft, covered in who knows what with the wet vac. So a lot of work was done. If you smell something funny in the elevator, that's the smell of progress. Enjoy it. It means something good is coming. It means we're making progress. But seriously, thank you all for all your hard work for the last two work days. We got a lot of stuff done, and I'm very grateful. I assume also, Lloyd, that the other reason why we might be thinner this morning is people read ahead and saw that it was Psalm 82 this morning and decided this is just too weird, and they're not going to do it. Psalm 82 is an odd little thing. It's not getting a lot of screen time from pulpits. It's not getting a whole lot of air time for a lot of things. I mean, Psalm 82 is great material for a really deep dive into commentary if you've got a couple of extra weeks, but it's not usually conducive to easy pulpit preaching for a couple of reasons. One is it addresses power, and anytime we address power, it's a little uncomfortable. In every generation, there's this comfortable assumption that those who hold power must somehow have earned it, yeah, that they deserve it, or they've been blessed for it, right? Kings historically rule because they claim that God put them there. I mean, even today, Charles had to sit on the magic stone from Scotland in order to be able to take the throne of England. There's some sort of divine right of kings. In fact, we call it the divine right of kings. Or we say that leaders lead because they're the wisest among us. Theoretically, that's what we hope for, usually. But Psalm 82 has a word for those comfortable assumptions, and it's not a comfortable word. Psalm 82 starts with a very strange setting, a scene that needs just a little bit of attention before I can completely dismiss it. It starts with God taking a seat in something the psalmist calls the divine council. And even if you just want to gloss over that and say whatever that means and just ignore it, that's fine, except the next couple of verses also say things like, and then God spoke to all the other gods and said, and now what do you do? You've got a couple of options. One really bad option is just to throw out the whole book and say it contradicts itself and therefore it's meaningless. I don't recommend it. Another option is to say that this was an ancient Hebrew way to say that God is a better God than all the other gods. That if you put God in the same room with, I don't know, Baal and Marduk and all the others, then clearly this God, this Yahweh, is the best and most just of all the gods. That holds up pretty well. It just isn't all that relevant for most modern audiences. But Walter Brueggemann and a handful of other really, really smart people, again, if you want to take the deep dive, go for it. I highly recommend it. Would also point out that in ancient Hebrew, I hate to do this, I don't like to play the ancient Hebrew card at the beginning of the sermon. In ancient Hebrew, words carried multiple meanings like they do in English, and one of those words was gods. It was not uncommon to refer to a group of rulers, human rulers, as gods. You didn't think they were gods. It was more honorific. It was a title. And so it was not uncommon in ancient Near Eastern cultures to refer to a group of kings as gods for a couple of reasons. One is sarcastically, satirically, they have the ego of gods, so let's just go ahead and call them that and get a little jab in. Another is just because of the very fact that in ancient Hebrew culture, the king was supposed to represent God. Not be God, but represent God, which is a distinction they picked up in Egypt, more than likely, and they kind of carried with them. Not necessarily a good practice, but it is what it is. In other words, all that to say, Psalm 82 is really weird, it's really awkward, but if you can rephrase it just a little bit in your head and get the setting straight, it makes a lot more sense. Psalm 82 is God sitting down with all the earthly leaders of the human leaders of Israel and saying, all right, you want to be gods? Where's your justice? In other words, Psalm 82 calls people of power to a standard in which they should live and rule the same way that God does. And they don't. The rich must be doing something right because they're rich. In the ancient Near Eastern world, power, divinity, it's all intertwined. Rulers were called gods, they're called sons of the Most High, not because anybody was confusing them with God, but because they were seen as God's agents on earth. Their duty was clear: protect the weak, defend the vulnerable, uphold justice. As long as they were doing that, the people assumed God was pleased. But comfort is a dangerous thing, and comfort convinces us that nothing needs to change. It blinds us to the cracks in the system. And if injustice is not directly hurting me, then I guess surely all must be well. In the worship life of Israel, psalms were sung that celebrated God's justice as the very foundation of the world. God was the righteous judge, the rock of salvation. But even those songs of justice could become background noise if no one paid attention to what they meant. And then comes in the middle of church one day a psalm like this one, a psalm that does not soothe, it summons. The word of the Lord from Psalm 82. God has taken his place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, he holds judgment. How long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? Give justice to the weak and the orphan. Maintain the right of the lowly and the destitute. Rescue the weak, the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked. They have neither knowledge nor understanding. They walk around in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are shaken. So I say, you are gods, children of the Most High, all of you. Nevertheless, you shall die like mortals and fall like any prince. So rise up, O God, judge the earth, for all the nations belong to you. The psalm opens with this heavenly courtroom. The gods, whether earthly rulers or spiritual powers, take their seats, perhaps expecting some ceremonial affirmation of their work, the proverbial pat on the back. Instead, the judge enters and levels an accusation. How long do you plan to keep judging unjustly and showing favoritism to those who are wicked? No context, no preamble, no water cooler talk, no how's the weather, it's been hot this summer. Just straight to the point. And the word falls like a hammer. The charge is devastating. There's no room to run. The doors are blocked. The judge has taken the seat. They have failed to defend the weak. They have neglected orphans. They have allowed the poor to be trampled. They have not rescued the oppressed. In fact, they have been oppressing the oppressed. These rulers were supposed to be God's representatives, but they have twisted justice into something self-serving. And so God sits down and says, I saw that. What you thought you could hide, I saw it. Jeremiah's voice joins in from our first reading. Same council meeting, seems like. Same point, at least. God's word is not just empty. It's this fire that consumes. It's the hammer that shatters stone. It's the Lord saying, do you think I'm far away and can't see what you're doing? I was right there. I saw every deed, every word. I know every one of the schemes that you've been plotting. You can't hide anything. And years later, it seems Jesus was at the same council, because in Luke 12, he says the same thing. I've come to bring fire to the earth, and how I wish I had already kindled it. You thought I was here to bring peace to the earth. No, it was division. This is the part of the gospel that doesn't fit neatly on a greeting card. It just, this is not the thing you're going to find scribbled at the bottom of a random Dollar Tree card that you're trying to send somebody who's sick. This is not the quotable Jesus that shows up on bumper stickers and cross stitches. This is the part of the gospel where Jesus refuses to allow a false peace to stand. This is the Christ who will not permit injustice to go unchallenged. If we listen carefully, we realize that this is not just about those rulers or corrupt systems or even current rulers or corrupt systems. This psalm, this fire, this hammer is aimed at anyone who would represent God and do a poor job. Injustice thrives not only where there is an active oppression. History has shown us that it also thrives where there is a passive silence. We can be complicit without even realizing it. When we benefit from unjust structures, when we keep quiet to protect our own comfort, when we assume someone else will step up and fix it, and we don't have to, God sits in that council and says, I saw that. Because Psalm 82 is a disruption. That's what it's supposed to be. It is God walking into the room where we have carefully arranged our assumptions and says, this is not how things will stand. This is not how we do things here. But there is a strange mercy in all of this judgment. In fact, I think the judgment that Psalm 82 delivers is an act of mercy itself. The judgment of all of these texts is not simply to tear down. It's not only destruction. There's an invitation to it. God does not only condemn the rulers. He calls them back to their original vocation. Yes, you've been doing it wrong. I've watched you do it wrong. Let's start doing it the right way. Give justice to the weak and the orphan. Maintain the right of the lowly, the destitute. Rescue the weak, the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked. There's this recommissioning, this recharging of what they're supposed to be doing. There's a second chance baked into this judgment. If God assumed, and rightly so probably, that there is no possibility of change, that this is just the way it's going to be, do you think God would have bothered to walk in the room and talk to them anyway? I don't think so. The plan was never just to disrupt. The plan was to disrupt for the sake of reorganizing underneath something better. This is what they were meant to do all along. It's what we're meant to do. God does not leave us to figure it out on our own. Never has, never will. The letter to the Hebrews draws us into this great cloud of witnesses, people who lived by faith in the face of injustice, who chose obedience to God over the approval of the powerful. They endured suffering, rejection, exile, even death, trusting that God's justice was real, that God's promises were worth it. And above all, we look to Jesus himself, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, who endured an unjust cross, scorning its shame, all for the joy of restoring all things. In him, we can see that judgment and grace are not opposites. Judgment is the surgical precision of love. Not when we do it, but when God does it. Judgment is the cutting away of what destroys so that life can flourish. We often call that pruning. And when God shows up differently than we expected, it's often through this pruning, this purifying work. A word that can feel like a hammer, but is also the same word that sets captives free. The fire that consumes is also warm and illuminating the path of the faithful. God's judgment itself is a grace with its sleeves rolled up. It's God saying, I love you too much to let you keep doing this. We can do better. So what does it look like on the other side of this courtroom scene? It means if we take our seat, not as spectators, but as participants in this divine council, if we are going to bear the name of God out into the world and sit in that room on one of those chairs, we are participants in God's justice. If Psalm 82 is God's charge to the rulers, then it becomes our commissioning to defend the weak, uphold the cause of the poor, rescue the oppressed. And that means we have to examine ourselves. Where have we become comfortable with the way that things are, even if it means harming others? Where have we been silent because speaking might cost us something? You don't like those questions. I don't like those questions, but they are necessary ones if we want to walk in the ways of Christ, to be ambassadors of God in this world. And that means we move toward action. And that's going to look different for each of us, isn't it? Some may be called to advocate publicly for those whose voices are ignored. Others may serve quietly, but persistently, in ways that restore dignity and hope. And still others of you might leverage their resources to create opportunities for those without resources and opportunities. But all of us are called to live in such a way that if God were to convene the room to sit among us in the divine council, that our lives would give evidence of justice done in God's name, not injustice. Our lives themselves become part of God's answer to the prayer that his kingdom come and his will be done on earth as it is in heaven. How do you think that's going to be accomplished without us doing those things, doing God's will here on earth as God does God's will on in heaven? It's a two-part system. Today is a really weird Sunday for me, and I debated saying this or not saying this because it's absolutely irrelevant to all of you, but I just feel really squidgy today, because today is the very last service of the church I was working at in Arizona before I came here. They're closing their doors. They're done. And that feels weird. I know you're not going to feel what I'm feeling, but that's weird. It's sad. It's disheartening. They dwindled into non-existence until all they could do was send out a mass group text this week to everybody in the database who's ever gone to the church and said, "We're closing our doors and we'd like to celebrate with you one last time." And then that's going to be the end of it. And I don't know what they're going to do next. The legalities, the process of shutting the doors of a church are awful, because you have to figure out what to do with things, with resources. What do you do with the stuff in the church? What do you do with the building itself? What do you do with the people? Where does it all go? Somebody who got the group text, besides me, sent me a text and said that they feel especially weird because this is the second church that they've been a part of that's closed this summer. And they don't know if that means that it's their fault and the curse is just following them around and every church they're going to be a part of is going to close. And they don't know what to do with that either. And they're off deployed somewhere right now and they can't even be part of this closure process. And then Faith finds a story this week that she tells me about yesterday, of all days, of a Lutheran church in Madison, Wisconsin, that's closed their doors last year. It's going around. And again, this is completely irrelevant. If you're reading too much into this, don't. We're not closing our doors. Everything's fine here. But around us, it's everywhere. This church in Madison, Wisconsin, was going to close their doors last year, and they probably talked about it for several years before that. In fact, I know of another church in Madison, Wisconsin that's trying to close their doors in the near future. But this particular church, St. John's in Madison, wanted to do it the best way possible, I guess, if there is such a thing. So they destroyed the building. They just knocked it to the ground, leveled it, because the real estate was much more valuable than the building was. And then they petitioned the Lutheran organization to build something else there. A 10-story skyscraper right in the middle of downtown Madison. And there's going to be a worship space for the church in that building, but much, much smaller and kind of more like a conference room than anything else. And there's going to be a couple of businesses on the lower level. And then they put in 130 apartments in the upper floors. 108 of those apartments are going to be made available for as low-income housing. And they decided that was the best use of their role in this council of God's justice. That if they couldn't survive the way that they always had for 200 years, that the best next thing would be to make sure that God's justice still had a place in that place in Madison, Wisconsin. And nobody liked it. It was hard. It was different. But you got to give them some points for creativity, don't you? Because even on their way out, they made space for God's justice to stay. And in its own way, that's beautiful, isn't it? These churches closing left and right all over the country. In fact, there's a whole new Church of Christ organization called Heritage 21. Do you know about Heritage 21? The joke is they're the Grim Reapers of the Churches of Christ, because it's a whole new nonprofit organization that goes around buying churches before they close their doors to try to use the resources for helping other churches. So they kind of, if Heritage 21 knocks on the door, then your time is numbered. It's going around. And that feels like a hammer descending upon you. It feels like God sitting down and saying, "Where's the justice? I've seen what you've been doing. It's time to weed things out." And that feels miserable. But perhaps some pruning will lead to something amazing. I don't know. I hope that that church in Arizona that I worked at for 5 years, that something amazing will come from that pruning. That God has a plan of scattering those people into other places to do amazing things. It's hard for us to see that, though, isn't it? It's hard for us because we come to a table week after week after week where the judge becomes a host. And that's weird, isn't it? The same Christ who warns of fire and division is the Christ who feeds us with mercy. And some days we just don't know what to do with that. The one who calls the world to account is the one who gives himself for the life of the world. Because God can do something we can't and can put mercy and judgment together and lead us to something more beautiful. In this bread and in this cup, we receive not just a token of peace, but we receive and give something of our own corruption. We offer that up, don't we? We receive the nourishment that we need to live as people of God's justice and love, but that means that sometimes we recognize we're not always a people of God's justice and love. Because at this table where divine truth meets divine grace, our failures are laid bare, but they are met with forgiveness. And we Christians hold those two things in tandem. We embrace this weird thing that we are hypocrites, and that means that we are people in the process of becoming something better. Where our fear is met with courage, where we can look around and see the news about churches closing their doors and somehow find hope in that, that God will create something beautiful out of all this closure. Where our weariness can be met with strength, Christians hold these things together hand in hand. We say things like God takes our weakness and creates perfection from it. So at this table, we gather as a bunch of people who are all weary, who are all hungry, who long for courage to face truth. And the table is set to provide hope and love and forgiveness and understanding. The table is set for Christ to meet us here. Yes, the Christ who wanted to set the fire ablaze, but ultimately the Christ who chose to die for us anyway. Psalm 82 is an odd little thing, isn't it? God sits down in the room and says, I've seen what you guys are up to, and it's awful. So how about we put a stop to that, reset things a little bit, and start over? And at the end of the summer, I think that might be an appropriate little message for God to look at all of us and say, I've seen what you're up to, your scheming, your plotting, the things you're doing. How about we reevaluate some of that, do a little bit of pruning, and get back at it? And that little bit of pruning, that getting back at it, that reevaluating, that's a wonderful thing to do around this table that we gather around, to accept that we are a complicated thing of both failure and forgiveness. And to deny either would be to deny us the very honesty of sitting in the room with God in the first place. So come to the table, bring the worst things you have imaginable, bring your honesty, bring your failures, your flaws, your faults, all of it, your fears. Let's reevaluate some things and choose to leave from this place, from that table, as ambassadors, as placeholders of God's judgment, God's justice, God's righteousness, God's love, in a world that I think we can all agree is desperately in need of all of these wonderful, beautiful things. Let's stand and sing.